You're listening to Yale Radio WYBC. This is Brainerd Carey with the Art World Demystified.
Today on our show, we're talking with Warren Nydick. He's an artist and a theorist. He's written a number of books and had many exhibitions around the world. Warren, thanks so much for being with us today.
It's my pleasure, and thank you for inviting me.
Let's talk about the show that I just saw. I was at Mannequin Temporary, and I saw this amazing installation that you did and had all this neon, and I want to discuss it. One of the things that I noticed was unlike a Kossuth approach where the neon lacked color, yours was filled with color and life. And can you just talk a little bit about that? I have a lot of questions, but can you begin talking about that?
Sure. I've been working on what you saw was what I call the diagram of cognitive activism. And that diagram has been evolving for the last 4 years. It started off actually as the diagram, what was called the Duende diagram, and it's evolved. And the reason I mention that is that this work is an ongoing becoming process. It's something that is continually added onto, and I'm still working on it. So it's not a finished thing, and then I exhibit it in its particular moment. And yes, there were a lot of colors, and I have, you know, I have a tremendous amount of respect for Joseph Kossuth. I mean, who couldn't? I feel he's one of the most important American artists, and his day will come again, sooner than later. Kossuth and many of the artists of his generation, I'm talking about the generation of 1965 to 1972, as it was, you know, elucidated by Lucy Lepard, in her fabulous book of concerning immateriality of art. Their ideas of the early conceptual artists was a kind of stripping of the aesthetics and a kind of ascetic aesthetics, I would call it, an ascetic aesthetic, where they were following certain kinds of philosophical positions, notably of Kant and Wittgenstein. They were trying to drain the artwork of all its aesthetic value, and in doing so, to try to highlight or foreground its pure meaning. Now, that was, that was an important step. We needed to do that, and that went along with other aspects of early conceptual art in which the immateriality of the art and its negotiation against certain kinds of early art market valorization that was taking place back then. In other words, the stripping of the aesthetic was a kind of rebellion against the art market trying to make artworks that were uncollectible. You would think here of the telepathy pieces of Robert Barry. You would think about the Lawrence Wiener's text pieces, which were placed right on the wall. You could also talk about Dennis Hubler and a lot of other artists at that time who were using early computer cards and using early kinds of reproductive machines, before the modern day printer. There were lots of earlier stages of automatic printing, home office kind of printing. They were using all these. Photography as another example of something at that time that wasn't collectible. It was all against this market value. Today, we live in a very, very different time, and we have to create an art. We have to create a conceptual art that is also up to date to the social, political, and economic conditions that we find ourselves in today. So, for instance, those conditions are not about creating an immaterial work of art, but operating against the immateriality of the knowledge economy and cyber culture and customization culture. So immateriality today means very different than making the immaterial work that was stripped of color and stripped of aesthetics and was immaterial, uncollectible, to now a kind of form of resistance to immaterial labor, which is the labor of the cognitariat, in which the mind and the brain are the new factories in the 21st century, and where value is created. So my work is what I call wet conceptualism, and what I mean by that is that I would call this earlier conceptual movement dry conceptualism. It's very dry. And my work, you could even talk about Liam Gillick's work. He would be another person that, I think would fit into this, vein, and also some of the Mexican, contemporary Mexican artists, where the work, instead of is taking more of a maybe a Bruce Nauman approach to neon, in that case, where you make colorful works that are engaging to the public and bring the public in and create affect. It's not only about, it's about creating emotion and creating affect, creating a doorway or an entrance into the artwork that wants the public, instead of just quoting to them and kind of, addressing them, allow the audience to participate more in the cognitive relationship. And so it's about an engagement and a more participatory work. So the colors and the flashing lights, you know, are ways of getting people interested again in theory, which I think has been taking a hit recently.
I think so too. Now, when I looked at that, there was so much there. It felt like notes for a lecture. It felt like, without initially knowing more about the content, though I've read more about it since then, it felt that it was a bit of a critique on capitalism and modernism. Can you talk a little bit about that? And,
sure.
And correct me if I'm wrong.
No, you're absolutely right. Thank you for noting that, and thank you for being sensitive to that, because it's absolutely true. This work is a diagram. It's a diagram, and in that sense, it's a kind of diagrammatic logic. And these diagrams I build, I construct, become my lectures, as you mentioned. I mean, you felt that already, but they also become my text that I write. So I've been writing a lot of books like The Psychopathologies of Cognitive Capitalism, for instance. There's number one and number two. And actually, this work is actually a diagrammatic representation of the theoretical universe or cosmology that I'm creating. And, this work, a lot of artists have been doing diagrams. I mean, you think of Joseph Beuys, for example, perfect example of someone who is very involved in diagrams. But the diagrams of Beuys and many other people who use diagrams, they're really more about a kind of fictions. They're graphic. They're graphemes. They're more about knowledge, about the way that knowledge is represented, and they're really more talking about that. And then if you have the artists like Mark Lombardi, who I knew Mark, wasn't his best friend, but I knew him and I knew his work, and saw his work many times at the Drawing Center. And at Pierogi, in fact, Pierogi had a whole show of his work. This work was an analysis, a political analysis of certain kinds of network and web-like structures. We live in a time where the network, we all know this, I mean, it's nothing that I'm saying, of course, everyone knows that we live in the moment of the network. The idea of networking, which was just a faint kind of idea in the 60s, has become a social motto. We live in a networking society, whether we're talking about our socially networking out there in the art world, or we're talking about interacting with other people in the networks of the internet. We are a networking society, and this is a kind of network. And Mark Lombardi was the first one who I came across who really understood, who understand the morphology of this network. And he moved the discussion into this, from the fiction, this fictional morphological representational mode, into a nonfiction analysis, an analysis of understanding that this kind of morphology, this network morphology, actually was important for understanding how things worked on the in the network society. Now, the reason I mention that is that my diagram that you saw, the neon diagram you saw at MANA, is also an example of a kind of nonfiction network structure that tries to get into the new ideas and new forms of institutional normalization processes and governmentalization processes, which are using the network like Facebook or gathering data on our choices on Google. These are the examples of like data, datafication, and customization of the consumer, which is being utilized today. I wanted to use, as Mark Lombardi did, I wanted to use a kind of network manifestation and morphology to get at the very basic ingredient of this new form of governmentalization. So, that's why that, that's where that's coming from.
So let's talk a little bit more about that, because the fact that you work in Berlin and LA is very interesting. I've interviewed artists, in different parts of the country and the world, and it seems to be that with an American, you're talking, as I understand it, in some ways, especially with cognitive capitalism and talking about big data, you're examining systems, you're examining culture, and you're examining and perhaps critiquing capitalism and how that functions in the art world. This isn't something that I see a lot coming from American artists. It's something that I see as more of a European influence. I mean, I'd like to talk about specifically what you're discussing, but is this also something that you notice culturally, or is that just my kind of perspective?
Well,
on
no,
it?
I mean, I think you're absolutely right again. I mean, I go between Los Angeles and Berlin, and in each environment, it's incredible the art system that operates in both environments. It's like almost non-overlapping. The European, a lot of my ideas are coming from continental philosophy, and I've embraced, different. I'm kind of coming out of a Deleuze, Derrida, Foucault, a lot of those people, Agamben, these are the people that, that my journey includes. And I am building on research that they've already done. When you're in Europe, art is much more ironic. It's more questioning. In America, It's like the difference. If you look at a Godard film, the perfect way of understanding the difference between America and looking at Europe is looking at film as an example. So you have, let's take Godard and Spielberg as two eminent filmmakers who represent the dichotomy that I find also exists in the art world. So Godard is always unmasking the technology and the apparatuses of cinema in itself. So that, for instance, in the opening scene of Maîprise, you see the actual apparatuses of the film being made. You see this guy with a long telephoto lens coming in on the face of a main actress, and then you have all of the apparatuses, the sound apparatuses, moving with the main character in the scene. So you're seeing, as you see the film, and the artifice of the film, you're aware of the artifice because you're seeing the technology and the apparatuses that are also operating. And the argument there is, yes, it's coming out of a more Marxian position of unveiling the importance of the worker and the way that things are produced. But it's also talking about that the various aspects of that world that is being shown, the social, political, economic, and historical conditions, are part of a machinic assemblage of which technology and the apparatus of cinematography, which it's representing, are all a part. Now, when you look at a Spielberg film, let's take, for instance, just name a film of Spielberg. Jurassic Park. Jurassic Park. Okay. Now, in Jurassic Park, it's like a seamless piece of satin with not a wrinkle in it, nothing ruffled. It's just seamless. You have this amazing technology. You have this amazing technology going on in special effects labs all over Venice, California, where incredible amounts of technology, computational technology, or The Matrix, for instance, even another example, not done by Spielberg, but in the same way, is being used. But you don't see any of it. It's completely not shown. And it says a lot about the way that technology in our culture and all the issues around technology are being understood. So in my work as well, I'm more reflective of a European position in the sense that, yes, I am. Obviously, America and the Silicon Valley is the center or the hub of new technologies and the knowledge economy. Yet there is very little criticism, at least absolutely in the art world. I don't want to get too far astray, but just the perfect example of what I mean by how we labor is that Starbucks has just confronted a problem that they've been having with their labor, because what's been going on in a lot of the like Starbucks is that they put their worker schedule on algorithms, like they what are called parametric algorithms. Parametric algorithms are where you can take an equation and you can fundamentally feed it many different factors that all interact together. So, for instance, they started factoring in their labor schedule based on the weather of the weather time, research on peak customers usage of the facilities, the location, the real estate location in a specific place, and a lot of other factors. And they started giving their workers to maximize their corporate profit. They started organizing their laborers to come in every 3 days. Or even 2 days sometimes. They would start giving their laborers their schedules. Well, it turned out that it was horrible for the laborer because they couldn't even make an appointment with the doctor for their kid, or couldn't even arrange for anything, because they didn't know what their schedule was until 3 days before, because of this algorithms and the way that algorithms or metadata is being used. And that is going on across the board. So that's an example of the kind of criticisms that are not even being looked at. Now, of course, Alex Galloway, the famous art critic from NYU, he's amazing and he understands all of these things and he's writing about it. And there are some other examples of people that I could talk about, but the critique is happening in a very small academic circle, and it certainly isn't infiltrating the art world.
And what's happening next? I mean, it's fascinating because I know also you have a background and past projects have been about the brain and a lot of cognitive pathologies, as you say. What's happening next? What are you involved in now? Will this show travel, or are you researching another aspect of this?
Well, this is a part of a whole different project. And what's going on is that you could look at this diagram, this evolving diagram that keeps on growing and growing, as a kind of a superstructure on which then I'm working and trying to figure out other ways how I could make artworks or how I could bring the discussion into various art projects. So yes, I've been I'm working on a number of things right now. I don't look at art. I mean, I make art objects. I make even paintings, believe it or not. I do research in ideas of how art can create what I call emancipation. Like when you start talking about the brain and you talk about the brain in cognitive capitalism, there are a number of things that are happening in cognitive capitalism, which are very interesting. As I said, when you move from secondary economies, the economies of industrial capitalism during the 19th century, and you move into what are called tertiary economies, customization economies, economies of the internet economies, the data intensive economies, you are also, by its very nature, as I explained, moving from the factory of production, of mass production, into the factory of the mind and the brain as being the new space for the production of wealth. Okay? So that's the first thing. So once you go there, you understand that just like in the 19th century, there was a man named Charles Taylor who created this idea of Taylorism, which was a scientific investigation of making work more efficient. So to actually make it more efficient, so the greater the profit of manufacturing. But that was all about the body. That was about the body, the body's interaction on the how the body moves. And if you think of the other research at that time, like the photographs of Moybridge or Marais, you understand that body movement and the investigation of movement was something happening cross-culturally. Today, one understands that as soon as you say the brain and the mind are the new factory of the 21st century, what you're absolutely engaging in is an idea that soon, and already going on, I shouldn't even say soon, is this investigation of how to make the brain more efficient, how to make the brain smarter, how to make it work faster. If you are going to have a brain now that is essential for manufacturing and profit, then it behooves those manufacturing and capitalism to make the brain more efficient. And but the difference is that there's a difference now, what Marx called, what the difference is that when you move from secondary economy to tertiary economy, you have to understand this idea of subsumption. And that is this idea of subsumption was the two ideas of subsumption were formal subsumption and real subsumption. Now, formal subsumption meant that only when you worked at the time that you were working. But when you were finished work, you were free. You could do whatever you wanted. And that was all the idea of the 50s that if we made work more efficient and a worker would have more time for freedom and for more time for enjoying themselves. You know, that was the utopia of the 1950s. But what we really found is, in fact, as we go from secondary to tertiary economies, what really happens is that formal subsumption becomes real subsumption. And what that real subsumption means is that we're working all the time. We don't have, there's no more weekends. There's no more, it was 24/7, you know. I'm in L.A. now. I was in Germany before. I'm at different time zones. I'm talking to you. You're 3 hours further along than I am. But I could be talking to Japan. And we're working 24/7. I don't have weekends anymore. Just an example. These are kinds of examples. Everything is work. I'm at an art opening, and I'm working socially networking. I'm on the internet, and all of a sudden I'm just looking for a pair of sneakers, but I'm generating data. I'm generating data that somebody else is using, not paying me for, by the way, but I'm generating data that Google's then selling to shoe companies. More important is the fact, and these are the essential qualities, of real subsumption, is that when I make these choices, I'm making a series of choices. It's not just about searching one thing. I may be on that Googling for an hour, looking at where vacations, looking at airfares, looking at shoes, looking at furniture, whatever it is I'm looking up. I'm communicating using Google Mail to friends. There's all kinds of data that's being generated from my conversations with people. And what happens is that in real subsumption, in this time where everything is work, they are creating customized data profiles of my thinking processes. Now, this is not some crazy idea, you know. I'm not a paranoid schizophrenic talking about people watching me what I'm doing. This is truth. This is real. They are now looking at all my data, and they can create patterns more than just like I wake up and I go to Amazon and they say, oh, there's a new book that you might enjoy. That's one kind of customization. But I'm talking about something that is, you know, that's going to become more and more apparent, is that it's about future customization. It's about the future, that the future is getting smaller and smaller, that this customization is creating parametric equations that will designate, these algorithms will designate what my future choices are based on a tremendous amount of data that see how my mental processes are operating. Okay? So that's the first thing. Second thing is, okay, I mean, that's probably enough for now. Yeah.
Well, that's totally fascinating. You know, so you know, in this kind of new economy and what we're moving towards, and the wanting the brain is you say to be more efficient. How is that interfacing with this kind of big data technologies that seem to almost run against that? Because we want to be able to be more efficient, use our mind in different ways. If I'm understanding what you're saying correctly, and at the same time we have these big data crunchers that are in effect almost narrowing our possibilities or limiting the ability for us to go beyond what we would normally do if these didn't exist. In other words, we're being fed things, like you're saying, beyond just here's more sneakers, here's more this, but this is going to increase.
You make a good point, and I think the basis of your question is that there seems to be two opposing conditions going on. On one hand,
yes,
creativity. We are all becoming we're a much more creative society. That creativity has become an important integral of work, and that you're saying that that creativity. And I think I'm following you. Just correct me if I'm wrong. Is it calls for more complexity, more complex environments, more complex choices, more complex possibilities. And on the other hand, I'm also saying that there is this other stream or this other thing that's happening, which is to make cognitive labor more efficient. And to make it more efficient, one would suppose that, in fact, making something more efficient would mean making it less complex, narrowing the choices, therefore the kinds of choices that would make, the kinds of data that would be produced would be faster and more intelligible to these particular systems. And I think that's true. I think that both are happening simultaneously, and one creates a problem for the other. So for instance, a perfect example, and I believe that, by the way, search engines that occur on Google will become part of our environment. And I want to talk a little bit about that because that relates to real subsumption. And I also want to get back to real subsumption in terms of how labor has changed so that collectively we finish the work. But before I do that, I want to say one thing, and I think you're right. I think that the model of Google, where you are searching something, you know that you, say, for instance, you and your wife would put in the word shoe, okay? Now, what would, or your kid, you three of you, you put in the word shoe, each of you on Google will get three very different ratings and three different types of information on your Google page. When you open up your Google page, and you can test this yourself, I mean, it's obvious, you can do it yourself, you will see the great variation in terms of what you're seeing, what she's seeing, and what your kid is seeing when they put the word shoe in. Because Google has been tracking your choices, and based on those choices, it created customization algorithm that is then going to spew back to you on your page, you know, the same, very, very different things depending on who you are. Okay? Would you agree with that, or would you notice that yourself ever?
Yes, absolutely. And okay. It's fascinating, okay. But yes. Yeah.
Okay, so then take example of a right-wing guy. Say who I'm right-wing or you're right-wing. I know you're not right-wing, but say you have a friend who's right-wing and I'm left-wing, right? And I've been making all these choices, and I put in the word, let's say, right-wing organizations. Or no, I put in political organizations. I just put the word political organizations. Now, what's going to happen if you're right-wing and you've been looking at right-wing causes and you've been looking at, you know, all kinds of data about neoliberalism or whatever, you're going to get back a reflection of your political views. This is also true. Trust me, it's true. So what happens over time is that this customization has political consequences, because over time, because you've been looking at your right wing and all of the choices you've been making politically in terms of what your searches have been around right wing issues, you're a member of this, you're a member of that, you support this candidate, you support that candidate, you're naturally interested in anti-abortion legislation or whatever it is, whereas I'm much more interested in a whole group of different politicians, and I'm interested in against pro-life, and I'm for giving better medical care, amidst the public medical care, and you know, all these kinds of things are going to be reflected in the kinds of data that I'm getting back. The customization of the Google page is going to reflect those political views. So what happens is that it already automatically enhances my political views to be more right-wing or poor left-wing, because I'm not seeing any of the other kinds of information. I'm seeing a specific kind of information that is, that is being promulgated by my past choices. So that has real political effects. Now, that's more efficient in a way. It's much more efficient. It's much more customized. But in the end, it has political consequences. Yeah?
Yeah. Fascinating. So one question I want to ask is, so in this, I mean, it seems like a situation that's not only very important that you're articulating and articulating well, but something that we all need to know more about. And in part, the lectures that you're doing based on the work that I saw and other work are helping, I would imagine, people to understand this and to, in some senses, liberate themselves from these structures by at least understanding them more? And if that is the case, and if not, correct me if I'm wrong, is there a different reception in Europe than there is in America when presenting these kind of ideas, which are important to all of us equally, but we obviously have very different...
I have studio visits here, and I can't say. I mean, I've it's been really interesting working here. I'm right now looking. I'm at a Standard Hotel. I'm on a balcony right now, overlooking this amazing patio where they have the swimming pool, and I'm looking at the El Mirador Hotel apartments and palm trees, and it's just amazing, the aesthetic here in Los Angeles. It's just, you know, I love it so much being here. And, I'm here, and then I noticed the last 4 years I moved one of my studios back to L.A. instead of New York. I went to L.A. because I felt much more in link with what other artists were doing here. Because in L.A. it's a much more radical and autonomous type of aesthetic production. And the art market is very intense and very strong, but it's not as strong as it is in New York. And there's a lot of autonomous zones, a lot of artists that run spaces, and it's a fascinating place. There isn't that critique, that we're talking about. However, there is a very burgeoning art scene here that is, much more autonomous than it is market-driven. So that's why I'm attracted here. Having said that, a lot of the work that I've been doing, like, for instance, the colorful colors that you see on the neon, were inspired by Los Angeles because people here are much more sensual. Their work is much more colorful and sensual. There's the whole, scene with the surfing and, all of these other kinds of lifestyle and body-oriented relationships that I find has really helped my work and has helped me as an artist to create and a kind of aesthetic style. So in regard to that, I'm installing a piece. I'm here in L.A. to install a piece at LAX Art, Lax Art. I don't know if you've heard of it. It's a really important independent space run by Lori Furstenberg here in Los Angeles. And I'm installing a piece, a neon piece, that says equal, not equal. It's just equal. It started with market value does not equal cultural value. And this was this big neon that I was going to make, which just said market value does not equal cultural value, because I was just responding to these incredible market values for various paintings that are coming up at Christie's that we've all heard about, Sotheby's and Christie's, $168 million for a Picasso, whatever. So you have this inequality of wealth, which is affecting even the art market and how artists will work and everything like that, But then what happened is that, I refined it from market value does not equal cultural value, that I felt that cultural value is more important than market value, and where is the role of cultural value in this whole negotiation process? And in America, it just seems that how much a work is worth then becomes a value for how good the work is, versus not understanding its implications as cultural value. So this was the whole thing, and then I decided that that was like too literal, and though I do believe in it, I changed that neon. And now it's just equal, not equal. And it's a beautiful minimalist sculpture that has an equal sign and then a slash through it, which every 5 seconds, And then it's very political because it's equal, not equal. But it becomes, is it about wealth distribution that's equal, not equal? Is it about democracy that's not equal, that's unequal? Is it about a chance in life is equal, not equal? So I changed it there, so that's... I don't know.
Well, has poetic overtones too. I think it brings us back to the beginning of the conversation about wet conceptualism, dry conceptualism, and that also to me has some poetic overtones because it applies so much internally and externally.
Well, that's it. The poetics is so important. You're so right, and that is a very important part. You're absolutely right, and I wanted to get back to that because what I'm arguing for in that diagram that we started the conversation with is an emancipatory. An emancipatory materialism that artists, rather than that artists that are free from the market, artists that do not operate in the market, or their artistic decisions are not announced through the market, they are making work that is a kind of creates an emancipatory materialism. In other words, their work as it infiltrates into the cultural habitus, that being possible still. Who knows in the next 10 years if it's not going to be possible, that every artist will have to work for the market or not. But at this point, we still have artists that are still working outside the market and autonomously. That's why I said about LA, that they're still working autonomously. They're working in their artist-run spaces and things like that. The galleries don't have much strength here. They are creating autonomous forms of art that form different kinds of materials if they make objects. And if they don't make objects, it's part of the discursive objects of thought and, an understanding. Whatever, poetry is a perfect example because language is so important in terms of determining certain kinds of cultural meanings that artists who work in poetry, you can understand that there's the distributions of sensibility, which is this art, the partage de sensibilité, which is this art idea by Jacques Rancière about that the political systems today operate, police their people through utilizing distributions of sensible, organized spaces, design spaces in the urban environment and in the virtual environment that we see when we operate on the computer, creating these very, very engineered computational structures that become our distribution of sensibilities, what we pay attention to through our sensible organs, our eyes, our ears, and nose and throat. And together, this is my addition, sculpt the neuroplasticity of the brain to create and normalize not only the distributions in the real virtual and virtual environment of our existential spaces, but actually affect the way that the neural network configurations of the brain are also constructed, thereby affecting the way that we think and the way that we understand. So that emancipatory gestures like poetry, like art that is unconnected to material engagements of the art market, have the potential to redistribute those sensibilities, to redistribute those cultural habituses, and therefore has secondary effects on how those kinds of cultural habituses, how they are constructed as memories and attention networks in the brain, and that have material consequences through the sculpting of the neuroplasticity.
Warren, it's been a pleasure talking with you. It's fascinating work that you're doing, and also very, very beautiful work. I want to thank you for doing it, and also thank you for talking with me today.
My pleasure.
You're listening to Yale Radio WIBC. This is Brainerd Carey with The Art World Demystified.